Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, October 8th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo, and today we're broadcasting from Tween Heart, California, Shadow Ridge Vacation Rentals, and a cabin in the woods. We're watching the sun come up with lots of tall pine trees, and we're close to Tween Heart Lake. This is a great way that we decided we were going to de-stress.
Absolutely. It's been 4 days now of just doing nothing but kicking back.
So thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday, so we're not missing, live at our new times from 10 to 11 Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24-7 on DrSaputo.com and PRN.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include, can you actually kiss cancer away?
And what can be done to treat the annoying ringing in the ears?
And why aren't Americans filling their prescriptions and getting the recommended tests they need?
Does taking a nap make you lazy?
And what about new research to curb C. diff?
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time on PRN.fm at 888-874-4888. If you didn't get that, it's 888-874-4888.
Okay.
So, can we kiss your cancer away?
Well, that's a little bit of a stretch, but it's a cute title.
Well, maybe not kiss it and make it better, but instead of kissing under the mistletoe,
there you go.
Using the mistletoe for cancer may extend life and improve the quality of life by affecting the immune cells. Now, the British Medical Journal reports that there are 30 different preparations of mistletoe. Boy, I never knew that.
Neither did I. It's amazing how complicated things go when you really get into the details of what's happening.
And they use it in Europe for cancer. And, in fact, Germany's insurance system even pays for this treatment. So let's talk about the value of mistletoe as an anti-cancer drug.
Okay. Well, we know that it does something because it wouldn't have 145,000 websites that mention it as a treatment for cancer. And it did develop from the great Rudolf Steiner, who developed the whole, he was an MD who developed the topic of anthroposophy. And what that's about is really looking at associations between the four postulated dimensions of the human body.
First of all, what's anthroposophy?
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, that's what I'm going to explain to you. So it's basically looking at intuitive thinking about the what they say are the assumed associations between the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and the ego. And it's a little out there for me, and certainly mainstream medicine hasn't gotten there. And it also looks at that relationship to plants, minerals, and the cosmos. So it's kind of a weak definition of it, but it gives you an idea that it's different from what the mainstream is. And basically, they look at different ways of preparing mistletoe so that it can be used in a way to try and fight cancer. And what it basically does is it there are probably 1,000 in vitro studies, which mean they're done outside the body, that have shown that mistletoe, or at least its main constituents, have anti-cancer activity. But it also shows that it has something to do with improving quality of life. So that's one of the reasons why it's being used. And sometimes it's even used with chemotherapy because it seems to make things better.
How does it work?
Well, nobody really knows except that it in these tests that have been done outside the body, it suppresses the growth of cancer. Those are called in vitro tests, Vicki. And that's a good way to do it. And the other thing is it may have some anti-angiogenic properties, which means that it can suppress the growth of new blood vessels that tumors must have in order to continue growing and certainly to metastasize.
Well, so how is it given? I mean, do you just cook it or what do you do with it?
Well, the ways it's produced, I'm not so sure, but the way it's given is subcutaneously, which is by injection. It can be given intravenously. You can put it into places where the tumor is, like the abdomen or the lung space, or directly inject it into the tumor.
That sounds like a good idea to inject it right into the tumor.
You know, it really does to me, too. And there are some other therapies that I've looked at that are complementary alternative that look at that set the stage for using these kinds of treatments by direct injection. So, you know, if it wasn't that my good friend Tom Cowan, who wrote The Four Pillars of Healthcare, who's an MD in the San Francisco area, who's been doing anthroposophic medicine for probably 25 or 30 years. I might pass over this, but he's really a brilliant guy. And he's been using things like mistletoe and reports that he has fairly good results from it. So to me, that means more than what I read in the literature that tells us a lot about what the general community thinks. And there you're looking at, it will depend on who you read. You know, if you look at the mainstream people who make an assessment of mistletoe, they're really condescending about it. And
well, are there any unwanted side effects with mistletoe? I mean, that's one of the things that we worry about so much with traditional therapies like chemo and radiation.
Yeah, well, see, chemo and radiation, we know there are disastrous side effects most of the time. And it's not like those are things you can take lightly. And it depends on who you read that determines whether or not the side effects that are happening are serious or not. Again, the mainstream people seem to be polarized against complementary and alternative approaches that they don't know much about. And so they're talking about saying it's a very dangerous drug and it shouldn't be used because it can cause things like anaphylaxis or hemorrhagic colitis or ulcers, or even things like sarcoidosis. Now, I think that's being a little bit ruthless on this particular product, because when you look at what the mainstream therapies do for cancer treatment, this is not that much of an issue. Although the conditions they mention sound serious, most people who are using it, and certainly in the German literature, they don't talk about all these things that are like sarcoidosis and a lot of anaphylaxis or hemorrhagic colitis. So I think overall, it's fairly safe to use, and it can be used in many different ways, and there are some interesting stories of people who have used it that are having reasonable results. So what we need to do is add that to our armamentarium of what we use to treat cancer.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about it, too, is that it does do some things for cancer that sound a lot more attractive than using chemo, because it gives you more energy, it decreases your pain, it increases your appetite, mm-hmm. it helps you to sleep better, it increases your motivation, it reduces the size of the tumor, it reduces the side effects from chemo and radiation, and it kills the cancer cells, and it decreases the angiogenesis, like you were talking about. So that's a lot of things.
Well, all those things you're saying now are written by the people on the other side. So what we need are some people who have common sense, who can look at both sides of the story and then decide what the best treatment is.
Well, does the FDA approve of it?
No, of course not. FDA is in bed with the pharmaceutical industry. They're not going to bring in some inexpensive treatment that's going to treat cancer when you could be spending $100,000 a year and gaining only a month or two sometimes, and not even that, of extended life, and then have all the side effects that go with it that everybody pretty much agrees in. So,
well, it seems like it's controversial, like most things are, maybe because they've had inconsistent results. But it's an old remedy that's been around for hundreds of years. I don't know, thousands, whatever it is. But I know it's
time.
An ancient remedy.
Uh-huh.
And would you recommend it?
Well, I might. I think it would depend on the situation. I think the big beef that I have is, where the hell is the National Institutes of Health at funding studies to look at this? And I have to admit, there are a couple of studies, or at least one that's going on now. That's a start. But it's a whole lot different when you try to get funding for a complementary and alternative treatment than when you try to get funding for Big Pharma's new product that's coming out that they need to have approved. So the government should be funding this kind of research. The Office of Complementary and Alternative Medicine should definitely be the people who are supporting it. I mean, you can't expect the pharmaceutical industry to support this, because they aren't going to support a natural, non-patentable treatment, particularly one that's inexpensive.
They couldn't make money out of it.
Yeah, it would cut right into their profits. And so the question you have to ask yourself is, why doesn't mainstream oncology do something to include treatments like this in their armamentarium? They stay loyal to Big Pharma. So why? Basically two reasons. One is all the brainwashing that goes on in their training, where all the condescending remarks are made about the lack of science that there is in complementary and alternative medicine, and how much science there is in the mainstream. And of course, that's where they make their first mistake. Remember about 10 years ago, I gave a talk to about 20 radiologists and oncologists about complementary and alternative medicine at one of our local hospitals?
Mm-hmm.
it was very interesting. There was me and there were about 20 of them. And as I was starting my presentation, somebody made the casual remark saying that, well, you know, Dr. Len, we have great science in what we do, and you're talking about something that has very little science at all.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was the introduction that started a bomb to go off from my end of it. I said, well, I anticipated this question, and I brought you some literature I think you might be interested in. So I'm going to warn you before we start, please don't shoot the messenger. Just take a look at this and see what the resources are that I'm presenting. So I brought three articles. One was from the Office of Technology Assessment. The other was from the British Medical Journal. And the other was from the Journal of the American Medical Association. And I asked them before we got started, I said, how much of what we do in mainstream medicine do you think is built on good science? And there were one fellow thought, well, about 90% because we're really scientific. And another fellow said, well, maybe it's just 80%. And somebody else thought, well, it could be as low as maybe 75%. And I said, well, have a look at these articles. And what they say here is it's quite the reverse of what you think. It's actually 15%. You could have heard a pin drop. And there was not much they could say because I had the articles there in my hand, and what they had were just comments that were based on their belief system. Then I asked them the really big question. I said, and what percentage of the articles that are published in our mainstream literature do you think are based on solid science? And they said, oh, well, you know, it must be 99% or maybe 98% or something like that, maybe even 95%.
Surprise.
Surprise. I said, well, it's just the reverse. According to these studies, it's 1%. Boy, talk about seeing people get excited quick. It was lots of conversation, but it stopped right there. And then I had their attention, and they were willing to listen to the few things that I was mentioning about what we should be doing to work together to try and find the best treatments that are possible to treat people who have cancer without having this polarized attitude that what we do is good and what the other guy does is not good.
Well, one of the reasons, too, is that traditional medicine has the backing of, like you mentioned earlier, the pharmaceutical companies.
Well, that's right.
And complementary alternative medicine doesn't have much money behind it. And so it's harder to get the tests. So a lot of the evidence is anecdotal.
Well, that's right. But it works both ways because the tests are anecdotal in the mainstream, and worse than that, bad information is published purposefully in order to be able to sell drugs. And that's where you get into the problem, because when you have the pharmaceutical industry doing the research, or at least interpreting the research, you got a major problem. And
well, that's been like another whole topic.
Well, it is, but it fits in with what we're talking about, because what we're looking for is open-minded people who will look beyond the confines of where their discipline stops, so that they will entertain new possibilities that stretch them beyond the limits of their own boundaries that they're taught from their discipline. That's the sign of a really brilliant person, somebody who's willing to take a look at this stuff in a very serious way and say, gee, isn't that interesting, rather than, oh, where's the data? Show me the data. And then coming up with their own data that's been published by a resource that we know is unreliable. When you're looking at the amount of research that's done by the National Institutes of Health and the amount that's done by people who are engaged in the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, there's about $90 billion a year spent by the pharmaceutical industry and about $30 billion by the National Institutes of Health. So what are you looking at here is a discrepancy, okay, of where the power is and how the information's interpreted.
And you have a lot on this in your book, A Return to Healing, as well as on the website, drsaputo.com.
Right. If you want to learn about the karma of Big Pharma, which is the title of one of the chapters in my book, A Return to Healing, go to Amazon and buy this thing, or go to the website and buy it, because you won't get a more complete story about what's gone wrong with healthcare today from the point of view of mainstream medicine. It shows the flaws in training and the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry, the problems we have with the FDA and the CDC and the World Health Organization, and it looks at the problems with every aspect of medicine that we have, and it provides solutions to how we can fix that today, because it's possible as long as we get organized and we make sure that we're moving in the right direction. So that's how we should be looking at what's happening here.
So don't go under the mistletoe with anyone else than me.
Well, that's right. Well, Now we know we've got something that's great. At Christmas time, I can't wait for mistletoe to come out. You know, one of the interesting things about mistletoe is it comes from so many different sources, and the sources from which it come determine a lot about whether or not it has a certain action. And the fact that the Germans have approved this as a treatment,
that their insurance pays for it,
yeah, is really big news, because it's telling you that there's something happening here that we should be paying attention to. And some of the things that they look at is, what tree is the mistletoe growing in? What season is it? How is it harvested? How is it prepared? Is it a homeopathic preparation, or is it something that's a little bit different than that? And all these questions are ones that need to be answered in a clear sort of way before we get into the real science of how to use products like this. You know, the whole field of complementary alternative medicine, for the most part, compared to the mainstream of medicine, is much safer. It's got people who have been testing it as individuals, and we're doing the best that we can to make sure that we're studying it in clinical trials, but also as individuals. And that's where we get into trouble, is that it's so different than how the Western mind works. But I'll have to tell you that the science, you know, we talk about due diligence and solid science in the Western paradigm. We couldn't be further from the truth. These studies that we do even throw out things like placebo. And when you're throwing out things like placebo, you've got a big issue here that is maybe perhaps the biggest thing that we use that's in the treatment that provides the effect that we're looking for. And just because it doesn't have an effect from the treatment that we're doing that's a biochemical effect doesn't mean it doesn't have a bioenergetic effect or some kind of other quantum effect that causes change that we want to see.
Like with homeopathy.
Well, exactly. That would be one of the weaker ways that I would look at things, but yes,
well,
indeed.
Well, look at your photon stimulator, too.
Well, there you're talking about a lot of energy medicine, indeed. Well, look at Reiki treatment. I mean, look at all kinds of energy treatments that are out there. Look at acupuncture and things like that. And you're looking at approaches that are so different from what we do in the mainstream of medicine. We just throw it out because the problem is we don't trust it.
Western medicine's finally coming around on acupuncture.
Well, yeah, it's about time.
I mean, it's only been around for 5,000 years or something.
I know. When that data came across in about 1970 or so from China, when Nixon had taken his trip to China and they brought back information about acupuncture and showed us this movie of a person who was having symptoms of or having an operation done with his chest open and only a few acupuncture needles doing the anesthesia. The
and
guy
was eating an orange.
I mean, when you see something like that, doesn't it kind of get your attention, Ziggy? I mean, my God, this is something that you could die for.
No groggy side effects from that one.
Right, and no complications from the anesthesia. And you'd think that in 40 years that maybe we'd have brought that forward just a little bit.
Plus he was getting his vitamin C.
Well, that's right. So there's a lot that we need to pay attention to that we don't, that it's very important to do, because unless we have an open mind and this integrative approach, we stay stuck in just the one single discipline that we have, which is what? Western medicine. We have so many economic sanctions on all the other disciplines because they don't get reimbursed for their services from insurance, that there's an unfair playing field here. And so we miss out on the benefit that could be provided by the other disciplines that are out there. And we need to be very careful about doing that because we give away the integrative approach.
Well, that's one of the reasons why we do this show. And we like to talk about health medicine and show people both opinions and both sides and give you enough information so you can make your own intelligent decisions.
Well, that's
right.
What
feels right for you. I mean, for heaven's sakes, if you're scared to death of needles, we're not going to recommend you get acupuncture, you know?
Exactly. All right. Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines at 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health or about what we're talking about, give us a call. And now it's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on healthy foods for lowering stress. So back with what can be done to treat ringing in your ears. Stay tuned.
Well, stress is rampant and the leading cause of disease. So fortunately, we can reduce stress naturally with healthy foods. And one of the things would be almonds and other nuts. They can reduce your stress. Because nuts are loaded with vitamin E, which boosts immunity, and it can make us healthy. And nuts are good sources of B vitamins and zinc, magnesium, omega oils, and nutrients that are often depleted when anxiety is high. So a handful a day is probably a good rule because you don't want to overdo the calories. And then about, you know, there's oily fish like salmon. And salmon is rich in the omega-3 fatty acids, which is a perfect dinner de-stress option. And omega-3s also boost mood and brain function, and they can help us deal with anxiety and depression. There was a study done in 2011 from Ohio State that showed a 20% reduction in anxiety in medical students who took omega-3 supplements. And the researchers discovered that omega-3s could lower stress-induced levels of cytokines. Those are compounds that promote inflammation, and that's a biggie because inflammation can lead to illness and heart attacks. And oily fish is also loaded with zinc and B vitamins and magnesium that reduce sugar addiction cycles, and they counteract the damaging effects of stress. And now, let's not forget my favorite, sorry to say here, chocolate.
Well, that'll de-stress anybody.
Well,
that's right.
A little chocolate reduces our stress levels.
Does a little more reduce a little more?
Well, no, not really. And it boosts our serotonin levels that help us deal with stress. So you say, how much? How much is enough? Well, you only need about an ounce and a half, which is about a tenth of a pound, or 40 grams.
That's like a sniff.
Like a square or two,
okay,
of dark chocolate, dark organic chocolate,
all right,
a day. And it releases the happy chemicals that are known as beta endorphins in the brain, and it gives us an energy boost, a boot. So now let's go from dark chocolate to dark leafy greens. Now, dark leafy greens like Swiss chard and kale, they're loaded with magnesium, and that's a major stress fighter that help us to relax our muscles, which we kind of know about with muscle cramps. A lot of times it's recommended to take magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
And they relax the muscle fibers, and they put us at ease, and they soothe out our stress nerves. And the green leafy foods contain folic acid, and that helps make dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter associated with pleasure. And then there's oranges and Brussels sprouts and broccoli and red and green peppers and strawberries, and those all contain a lot of vitamin C, which boosts our immune system and fights brain cell damage from constant exposure to cortisol, and that's what we get from all the stress. And stress makes our bodies release more free radicals, and vitamin C helps to keep the free radicals in control, and it repairs and protects the body from the cumulative effects of stress. So, if you want to lower your stress levels, eat healthy, and stay away from sugary and processed and refined foods with artificial preservatives and additives. And remember, seeds and nuts and herbs and spices, as the nutritionist Ed Bauman says, and have a nice day, and you'll feel better.
Isn't Mother Nature perfect? I mean, she offers us so many things that are exactly right if we just have sense enough not to screw it up by processing and refining and storing and doing all the things that we do. Fresh whole food that is natural, that hasn't been altered, does wonders for the human body for some strange reason.
You say, listen to nature, and here we are now. The sun has risen, and we are in the woods.
Okay, so
in a cabin in the woods, and this is just an amazing place here in Twainhart,
this
California.
Is a great, talk about de-stressing. You know, I'm looking outside, and I see tall pine trees and redwood trees, and you know, the sun is just starting to come up. It's really beautiful.
And it's very quiet. You see, it's off-season here.
Yeah, this is great.
This is a good time, and the weather's still good. Anyway, is there a treatment for tinnitus, ringing in the ears? And by the way, if you have any questions or you want to join in our conversation, the number here at Prescriptions for Health is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. So tinnitus, how annoying to have ringing or hissing or roaring or whistling or chirping or clicking in your ears. That sounds crazy making in itself.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, what causes this and how common is it, Will?
Well, there are a lot of causes, Vicki. I mean, you can start right with aspirin or NSAIDs. If you take a lot of those, then one of the side effects you get is ringing in your ears. But even things like wax in your ears or allergies or infections can do it. And then there are a whole bunch
even
of things.
Even CMJ and cervical disc problems can cause it.
For sure. And sometimes loud sounds will do it. And there's this thing called acoustic neuromas, which is a non-cancerous tumor on the eighth cranial nerve, which is the auditory nerve. When it gets into there, sometimes you have problems with symptoms that are like this.
When I heard that there were 50 million Americans that have this problem of tinnitus,
right,
and then I started thinking about, because that's an awful lot, and then when we were looking up the drugs that have this as a side effect, it was like, no wonder there's so many. First of all, you mentioned aspirin.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of people that take aspirin.
I'll say.
I mean, think about it. A lot of people think that it's going to prevent a heart attack, so they take aspirin
exactly.
instead of taking the safe fish oil. You
exactly.
know? And then there's NSAIDs, which
right.
are so common.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other ones besides chemo and diuretics? And
well, look at antibiotics. I mean, there's a real surprise. And actually, antibiotics are one of the most common causes of deafness. So we're looking at treatments here that are saying, you know, we always say, well, not sure if it's a virus or an antibiotic, but or a virus or a bacteria, but an antibiotic's not going to hurt you, but it certainly is. I mean, the side effect, I mean, when you look at 400,000 deaths a year caused by the pharmaceutical drugs that we take, antibiotics are part of that picture, and it's something that we should be paying attention to and not using them anywhere near to the extent that we are, because they're just not that safe.
Well, the other thing, too, is that there's diseases that ringing in the ears is associated with, like autoimmune diseases and
mm-hmm.
Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And there are a lot of other things that cause it, too. I mean, even the antidepressants or B12 deficiencies or going off anti-anxiety drugs can do it. It's sort of like a side effect that's like the addictive withdrawal.
Yeah, that you they see. Recommend you take one.
Take more of it, yeah.
Take one. Well, see, many people, and this isn't any big shock, but a Loyola study shows that patients with chronic tinnitus also suffer depression and anxiety mm-hmm. three times as much as a normal person would. Well, it's like, well, duh. I mean, if you have these phantom sounds that are in your ears going on all the time, I mean, of course it's going to be more pronounced in people that are depressed. And then the antidepressants, they take antidepressants because they've got tinnitus, and then they end up
maybe with more tinnitus.
More tinnitus from the antidepressants.
Yeah, well, see, the thing that this particular article is looking at is magnetic therapy for treating tinnitus. And basically, they have this thing where they give transcranial magnetic stimulation and short pulses of magnetic fields to the brain. And that seems to help it. So it's an interesting way to approach this that hasn't been in the mainstream but is now coming into more popular vogue.
Are there side effects from doing that?
Not really. It's a pretty safe thing to do. And it's used, of course, to treat depression as its primary thing. And there are places where you can go now where this technology is available that it doesn't solve the reason why people are having their depression, but it does help with the symptoms in a non-aggressive way that's fairly safe. The other thing that works pretty well is a photon stimulator. You know, we haven't talked about that much here, but this is a device that provides infrared light therapy using LEDs that are at a wavelength of about 860 nanometers. And so it's near infrared light. And a lot of people who have TMJ problems and cervical disc problems that cause tinnitus, and this is common, this is not uncommon, they have that, and you treat them with the photon stimulator for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. Very often, you not only get rid of the symptoms of the TMJ or the cervical disc, but you get rid of the tinnitus that goes with it. So we're looking at some things here that are really innovative and new that we should be taking a look at more often when we're looking at conditions like this, because they're really important to consider when they're non-invasive like this. Anyway, it's time for a PRN.FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio on the Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, we'll be talking about why Americans are not filling their prescriptions or getting the recommended tests. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
There are a lot of Americans that are not filling their drug prescriptions, and they're skipping their doctor visits and medical tests and procedures. And a lot of it's because of financial hardships. But is this really a bad thing? You know, there's half of U.S. adults are taking an average of 4 prescription drugs, and young adults under 40 an average of 2. And then it was making me think about these doctor strikes that we had a few years ago, and the death rates ended up going down.
Well,
so I thought, well, maybe it's not such a bad thing that people aren't doing all these things.
Well, they actually didn't go down, Vicki. What they did is they didn't go up, and that shocked everybody. and you'd think that if doctors aren't taking care of people in the hospital, I mean, this is really a place where people are sick, that they would have to be dying and serious things happening. And it's not like they were left with no care and they were left with less care. But sometimes less is more. And in this particular situation, you'd have to wonder, because when you're using this number of drugs in such a non-scientific way, I want to repeat that, a non-scientific way, this is the worst science on the planet. And the reason for that is we go ahead and we get the FDA to approve the research that's been done by the pharmaceutical industry or whoever comes out with a product. And we approve what they do for one drug. And even then, after a couple of years, about a quarter of them are either taken off the market or they have a black box warning, which is the most severe warning that something serious could happen if you use this medication.
So much of the time we're the guinea pigs.
Well, that's exactly right. So when we're looking at things that are not so safe as individual drugs, what happens when you use two drugs together? What do you think that does to your biochemistry?
Or 4.
Or 8. Or 20. Or 30. When somebody's in the hospital, I've seen people on 30 drugs at one time. To me, you know, people do reasonably well, even though we do all these things to them. And we think that because somebody's in the hospital, they're pretty sick, and somehow they manage to get well, that it's the treatment that we did that made the difference. And there was a fellow named Albert Schweitzer, okay, Dr. Albert Schweitzer, who made the statement that his job as a physician was to introduce patients to their inner healer. Now, if you tell this story to doctors in the hospital, they're going to laugh at you and tell you, what are you, crazy? This person has an infection, they need an antibiotic, or they've got this heart attack, and we have to do these drugs to make sure they don't have a rhythm disturbance or go into congestive heart failure. And I agree, that is an issue. But the point here is that we overdo medicines. America is over-medicated.
And then we end up giving people more medications to counteract the side effects from the previous medication that they were taking.
Well, that's how you wind up when a person comes into the hospital with what we call standing orders. We give a sleeping pill for this. We give an anxiety drug for that. We give
pill.
A stool softener for that. Yeah, these are, like you're right, there's a pain pill for so we don't get bothered at 2 in the morning with problems, but we're talking about people's lives here. And maybe we're too busy as doctors, you know, when we're in the hospital. It's hard to manage 8 or 10 or 15 patients in the hospital and give them the care that they deserve. And so our tendency is to depend on using pharmaceutical drugs to manage what's happening. Now, I'll say there's a place here that's a compromise. Of course medicines do some good things. But what would the survival rates do if people stopped their medications? It's not a stupid thought.
Well, we're not recommending that people just stop their medications.
Certainly not. But we're talking to the doctors of America out there and asking you the question, are you sure that what you're doing with your medications is going to be saving lives, or is it actually going to be costing lives? Because there are 400,000 deaths every year that are caused by the use of medications.
Well, also, there are a lot of conditions and illnesses that can be corrected and managed by a healthy lifestyle.
Absolutely.
And so the drugs should really be the last resort. Like, for example, antidepressants. We've talked so many times before about this because they've done studies with antidepressants and placebos, and the antidepressants didn't work any better than the placebo. The same thing if a person has hypertension. If they live a healthy lifestyle and they get enough exercise and they can reduce their stress and they get enough rest and so forth, they can usually reduce their blood pressure on their own. Same thing with diabetes. If you eat a healthy diet and you get enough exercise, many times you can keep it in check or you can get rid of your diabetes without even having to take all those drugs.
Well, you're making a good point there.
Same thing with heart attacks.
Well, keep in mind that when we use medications, we're complicating things a lot. And if there's a way to do it by not doing medications, we should. When you look at things like low levels of vitamin D, you know, we just talked about that a week or two ago, that in the ICU, the pediatric ICU, the kids that had low levels of vitamin D fared much worse than those that had higher levels of vitamin D. And, of course, who's getting sunlight between 10 and 2 when they're in the hospital? Nobody. Plus, there's an epidemic of it. And how about supporting the immune system? And how about the metabolic needs that everybody has that are ignored when we're looking at the nutritional status of people because they're sick in the hospital and we're giving them the minimum daily requirements because we don't know that much about nutrition?
Okay, so there's other things here besides the prescriptions that we talked about at the very beginning, like some of the medical tests and procedures. I mean, we've talked before, too, many times about mammograms. Many of these types of tests can actually cause what you're trying to prevent, like mammograms with the radiation. Maybe some of the colonoscopies can have complications and so forth. So we need to think about all these things. If they're safe before we do them, are we overdoing them? Are we?
That's it. Very simple, Vicki.
Support the doctor.
America is over-medicated. We need medicines, but we need less of them, and they should be handed out more carefully. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on foods not to eat while you're sick or battling a cold. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the stinging that makes you lazy, and finally, new research on how to curb the chill, get a colitis.
Oh, here we go again, this time of year where we start passing around colds. You know, there are a lot of sources out there for natural cold remedies like garlic and ginger and hydration and vitamin D and C. And it's also good to know which foods to avoid when you're sick or you're battling a cold, because if you can eliminate some of these foods, you can boost your immune system and you can also recover faster and you can reduce the severity of your symptoms. Now, one of the things happens to be alcohol, because it weakens your immune system and it dehydrates you, and it can make colds more miserable. So if you can, steer clear of most of the alcohol to keep your body hydrated and your immune system functioning well. And it's also best to avoid dairy products because they can increase your mucus production. And another thing is, don't go running for that run-of-the-mill orange juice when you get a cold, because the average juices they're just loaded with extra sugar, and the sugar can reduce the ability of the white blood cells to fight illness. And any benefits that you might get from the C end up being nullified by the sugar inside of it. So
right,
if you want a juice, squeeze your own, and better yet, eat the whole orange, because the fiber's in it, and it's the antidote for the fructose that's in the orange. And the main point here really is to just avoiding juices is to avoid sugar. Also, you want to stay away from bad fats, trans fats, and the other unhealthy fats like refined oils when you're sick, or really if you're well too and you don't want to get sick. Especially processed snacks and fried foods, and these bad fats produce inflammation, and the inflammation produces a less active immune system. Also, steer clear of fast food and processed foods, especially when you're sick, because they're mostly void of nutritional value or of boosting the immune system. So you want to amplify your health, and many of the foods are made from genetically modified foods, and they contain a slew of immune-suppressing ingredients like the high-fructose corn syrup and aspartame and MSG, artificial colors, FDC, red number and
right.
The red number 40, and dimethyl polysiloxane, which is a silicone that's found in a lot of things you don't want to know about, like silly putty. So,
silly putty in your food, yeah, right.
So if you want to prevent a cold, you need to avoid foods that make you sick and consume foods that boost your immune system. So when you're sick, stick with a diet of whole, fresh, organic foods, plenty of liquids, not the sugary kind, drink tea and eat soup and use spices like turmeric and ginger and garlic and consume honey as your sweetener and just go the natural route. Because the worst symptoms of a cold will only last a few days when you have a high-functioning immune system, and it'll shorten your symptoms. And you want to treat your whole body with good nutrition and rest, and just don't go for this over-the-counter runny nose drugs.
That's right.
Because they just treat the nose, and they
Don't shorten the cold at all.
They don't shorten the cold. You want to do healthy things.
Well, that's a great...
I know what I do. As soon as I'm going to get a cold, I take a whole bunch of D.
Vitamin D, yeah. Well, we should be getting more sunlight, all of us. You know, it only takes about one soft drink every 8 hours to suppress your white cells from being able to engulf and fight microbes that are in our body. It's amazing. And we consume so much in the way of soft drinks. That's what happens.
So are you embarrassed to take a nap? Oh.
I'm not.
Oh, if someone on the phone calls and wakes you, do you admit you were snoozing? Or do you try to resist taking a nap when you can and push on when you're tired? You know, research now shows that it's healthy to take a short early afternoon power nap, as long as it's not when you're driving.
Well, that happens all too often. You know, I'd say most people every year or two have one short episode where they fall asleep at the wheel. It's more common than you'd realize. And it's the cause of a lot of accidents.
I have to keep an eye on you.
I know. You're right. Yeah, it's sort of like it lulls me to sleep.
Yeah, it lulls a person to sleep. So you got to get enough rest is the main thing, and keep snacks and stuff in your car, too, to keep you healthy snacks.
Well, you know,
keep you going.
It's interesting how people like Albert Einstein and Leonardo da Vinci and Nikola Tesla and Winston Churchill and JFK all had one thing in common. That was a daily mid-afternoon nap. And a study came out looking at this. It was a Greek study.
Unless Saputo, we can add to that list.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you want to add me to that list, but yes, I take a nap. Sometimes I take a nap when I don't want to at the office. It's amazing. Right after lunch, it's a natural time for us to want to rest because our body rhythms say you should sleep. And that's why people... And from a lot of countries, they're taking the well-known siesta.
Well, that's what's really hard. If you give a lecture or talk to a group right after lunch, boy, everybody
wants to go to sleep.
Wants to go to sleep.
I found myself on occasion when I'm right after lunch and I'm in talking to somebody about a health issue, to actually nod off. Yeah.
Oh, that's unforgivable.
Well, it is. It is unforgivable. I remember.
Did they ever come back?
Oh yeah. No, I remember sitting there one time and I kind of nodded off, and the patient just almost shrieked and said, "Are you okay?" Something bad has happened to me. And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I think I had too big a lunch today." That doesn't happen very often.
Well, what happens is all the blood goes to your stomach, leaves your head, I guess.
Well, that's what they say.
It goes to your stomach to digest it.
Well, anyway, this Greek study looked at men who took a 30-minute nap at least three times a week. And then they looked at the risk for dying from a heart attack and found it was 37% lower. So there's something to this that we should be paying some attention to. And there are some organizations that are. Companies like Google has nap pods, okay, that create kind of like a sleeping oasis by blocking out sound and light. And there are people at the Hearst Corporation and Newsweek and Time Warner that offer people the opportunity to take a short little break by taking a little quick nap.
Well, I think that we need to talk to Gabby and tell her to not give you a patient right after lunch. You need to have a little power nap.
Well, I think what I need to do is not have one where I'm sitting down and I'm listening to somebody's story. Maybe I should be doing something that's more active, like giving light therapy or some of the other things.
Or
standing up and moving around. Okay,
well, I went to a counselor one time many years ago, and it was in the afternoon, and she started dozing off.
Oh, I remember that, you telling me
that
about
it. It really made me mad.
Well, you're paying a lot of money to get somebody's attention, and then they fall asleep. It's kind of like, hello?
Well, anyway, so why is it healthy? Well, according to this article, it's linked to clarity, performance,
mental clarity, yeah.
Memory, mood, and heart health,
mm-hmm.
because that was kind of a biggie about the heart health. They showed that it decreased the risk of getting a heart attack,
mm-hmm.
of dying from a heart attack, 37%. And it's not a good idea to ward off your afternoon sleepiness with caffeine and sugar and all, because then you end up with energy spikes, and then you get the crashes, and plus it's fattening and stuff anyway.
Well, you're right.
But anyway, this is a nurturing and a productive habit, so people need to you know, listen to their bodies. If you're tired, go ahead and take your nap, and it reverses your aging. You know, we're always talking about anti-aging medicine, and it's supposed to increase your sex drive and increase your motor tasks, and it uses your carbohydrates better and decreases your stress hormones and decreases migraines and brain chatter at bedtime. So go for your nap.
Yeah, good idea. I can remember when I was a resident and I was working long hours, I could take a two-minute power nap standing up, and it was no problem because we were on for...
Nay!
Really? Well, that's right, but you know, we're on for 36 hours straight, seeing lots of patients off for 12 hours and did that cycle for months at a time, and I can tell you, you don't get enough sleep. And I remember one time...
Yeah, you took a long nap.
I took a long...
36-hour long nap.
Well, it was unbelievable. I was at the VA hospital covering the emergency room, and you'd have to think, well, you're not going to get any sleep there. But on this particular time, I went to bed at, I think, at 5 or 6 in the afternoon, and I didn't wake up till Monday morning. And I couldn't believe that I never got called, but boy, was I rested. And did
well,
I ever
know,
need it?
But you know, you really only need a 10 minute, 20 minutes, a little better.
Well, 30, not when you're a 30, medical resident.
And 30 minutes is probably max, because if you take over 45, it might interrupt your sleep at night, you know, when you want to go to bed at night. So take, you know, try if you can to get a nap that's less than 45 minutes between the hours of 1 and 3.
Well, that's right. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from Ray from Yonkers. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Dr. Saputo and Nurse Vicki.
Hi,
Thank
Ray.
You for taking my call. I'd like to ask you about the phototonic stimulator with an LED. Can one buy the photo stimulator? Do you have to have a license? Can you apply the therapy by oneself?
You definitely can buy them. They're all over TV now. And the problem is you never know if you're getting one that's a good one or not. And it's about the intensity of power that's delivered. And usually we should be looking at the number of milliwatts or watts per square centimeter that are there. And most of the good machines are ones that are going to deliver probably in the range of 300 or 400 milliwatts per square centimeter. And you're looking at a cost there usually of anywhere from a few hundred dollars to as much as $5,000 or $10,000. I know the equipment that I have, which is all experimental that you can't buy, one piece that we use to treat neuropathies costs $500,000 to make. And, of course, we put people's feet in that for about 10 minutes. And those people that have the numbness and the pain that comes from diabetic neuropathy or chemotherapy-induced neuropathy is on the spot, helped immensely. And
well,
usually,
you're doing a big study on it now, too.
Yeah, we've got an NIH grant at the University of California, San Francisco, that's in progress now for about $7 million to look at chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. So we have the advantage of using really sophisticated equipment that I think is you can't buy. And the way that we deliver it is quite a bit different from any photon stimulator that's on the market. These are all trade secrets now that are owned by the person that I work with. And eventually this information is going to be made available and products coming out that are really high quality, amazing products. But I think we're looking at a few years because we have to wait for the research to be concluded before the FDA will even take a look at it. So I hope that answered your question.
Ray, do you have a problem that you think you might need to use it?
Oh, okay. All right, so thanks, Ray, for the call. We appreciate it. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, C. difficile, it's a vicious bacterial infection with life-threatening diarrhea, fever, abdominal pain, and colitis, and it affects about 336,000 people every year, killing 14,000 and costing $1 billion a year. Now, C. difficile, also known as C. diff or Clostridium difficile, is a bacteria that's caused by antibiotics killing the good bacteria and allowing the dormant C. difficile in the intestines to become active. So let's talk about how this is treated in conventional medicine and about the new research to curb it.
You know, Vicki, you're amazing at what you know. I wish there were more doctors that understood some of the things that you do about medical practice. And it's always a joy to talk with you about a lot of these topics because you're just a fountain of knowledge. And you're studying all these things that I do. We're going to have to promote you to some higher rank than what you are. This is all great stuff. And you're right. There is a lot that can be done about preventing C. difficile enterocolitis now, today, and there was 20 years ago and 30 years ago.
And what they're still doing in conventional medical practice is treating it with more antibiotics.
This is insanity. When you have a problem that's caused by antibiotics and you have overgrowth of those microbes that are resistant to the antibiotic, like C. difficile, you're going to wind up with a problem with this microbe that's going to be very difficult to treat, and you're going to be upsetting the ecosystem of the gut in a very serious way, because now that complex ecosystem that has thousands of different species of microbes that live in very carefully planned niches is going to be upset.
Oh, but now we've got some wonderful new research that's suggesting some things to take along with the antibiotic help to clear the antibiotic, to clear the C. difficile in about 5 days. It's called intestinal alkaline phosphate. What's that?
It's something that is just a chemical that the bowel makes that can be given in larger amounts that will help to protect against the C. difficile from residing there so fast, because it causes the excretion of it at a faster pace. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad idea, but let's get real. What causes the damn thing in the first place? It's a treatment that we use that kills the normal flora there.
And yeah, but before we do that, I want to talk about their other suggestion besides this enzyme.
Okay.
What about the mutated genes that can cause... end up causing recurrence and backfire and make it worse?
Yeah, see, well, some people have more of the ability to develop this infection because of their genetic makeup. And, of course, if you have that, then you've got to be especially careful. Now, this is silliness. If you know how to solve this problem in the first place, do that. If you're going to treat somebody with an antibiotic, try not to give it by mouth. You can give it intravenously if you're in the hospital. If you're going to give an antibiotic, you can use probiotics at times when you're not doing that. You can support the normal metabolism of the gut by using probiotics and by adding an amino acid called L-glutamine or a product like UltraClear Sustain, which provides all the nutrients that the body needs. You can use things like Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a friendly yeast that doesn't cause yeast problems, that crowds out a lot of those bacteria that you don't want there, like C. diff. And then you won't get this thing in the first place.
And also a lot of people on antibiotics end up with yeast infections.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are lots of, and I'm not saying you shouldn't use antibiotics. There are times when it's absolutely life-saving, but it's not the kind of thing that you want to just indiscriminately use, and we do that particularly when we're in the hospital trying to protect against infections we're not sure what they are, or when we're out of the hospital and we've got some kind of virus and somebody wants to be sure they're doing everything they can because they don't want to have a problem with the infection that can follow it.
Okay, so instead of treating it with what causes it, and if adding a mutated gene and then you have to use more antibiotics, I want you to talk about what kind of success rate you have with your protocol of the probiotics, the Saccharomyces boulardii, and L-glutamine and so forth.
Well, it's been great. I mean, you can definitely prevent these infections. And there's a lot of research about that that's very clear. There's no question that these things work. But the thing that bugs me the most is we're using powerful things like vancomycin to try and treat the C. difficile infection that's occurred, when all we really need to do is add the probiotics to repopulate the microflora of the gut with the right things to support the gut with things like L-glutamine, the UltraClear Sustain, and maybe a little quercetin to reduce the inflammation. And all these people, for the most part, are going to get well.
And plus, you won't even have a problem of ringing in the ears.
Well, that's right. That's right. You're not likely to. So there's a lot that can be done that's just common sense, but we stay stuck in this attitude of fighting a war against microbes, and we should be supporting the health of the good ones that we need there rather than trying to just kill everything in sight when a bad one comes in store.
And when they have this headline with these two new studies that are reporting what we were just talking about, they don't even mention probiotics or any of these this other protocol.
Well, that's because they're stuck in the same paradigm that the rest of medicine is. It's like a fight against nature rather than it is trying to support wellness. That's why lifestyle is your most important medicine and protects us against all the things that are going wrong are caused by bad diet, lack of exercise, stress, lack of sleep, weighing too much, not having a meaningful purpose in your life. All these things are absolutely vital, and we don't do anything to try and support that like we should. So when we're looking at upsetting the ecosystem of the gut and then coming back with a huge antibiotic to kill the C. diff, we've got a big problem of how are we going to restore that back to normal. And it's like a forest fire that's coming through that is wiping out a forest, and then we throw a few seeds out, you know, of redwood trees and think that we're going to fix it in a couple of weeks. It's not going to happen. Anyway, we're at the end of the show. Thanks for joining us. I'd like to remind you that we're back to talk about what's new in the news and health, to take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for health will also be available 24/7 on DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics that we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life. And we're off to go get our
little dose of it today.
Well, we're off to get our brand new little adopted kitten.
Oh, little kitty.
Actually, it's not a kitten, it's a cat.
All right, have a great week. We'll see you next time.